This is SiriusXM Doctor Radio.
From the heart of the NYU Langone Medical Center, this is Everyday Health with Dr. Carol Bernstein.
Welcome to all of our listeners to one of your very favorite Doctor Radio shows here at SiriusXM 110. I'm Dr. Carol Bernstein, an associate professor of psychiatry and neurology and vice chair for education in the Department of Psychiatry here at NYU. And for those of you who tweet, you can follow us on Twitter at NYU Docs to find out what we're talking about as we're talking about it. And remember, the purpose of Dr. Radio, the reason we're here in the first place, is to provide you, the listening audience, with access to experts in the field of medicine who can respond to your comments and answer your questions. So do jot down 1-877-NYU-DOCS. That's 1-877-698-3627. You can also email us at docs@SiriusXM.com. And before I get to my first guest about a very fascinating topic, let me tell you what's coming up later on in the show. In our second half hour, it's going to be open phones. That means you're going to be able to call me with all of your questions and concerns about issues in mental health, depression, anxiety, phobias, PTSD, ADHD, any stress, any of those. So remember, second half hour is open phones. In our final hour, we're going to be talking about friendship and how that matters for your physical health and your emotional literacy. We're going to have two wonderful guests, Dr. Wendy Satin Rappaport, PsyD, LCSW. She's an adjunct professor of medicine at the Diabetes Research Institute at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. She's specialized in individual marital, family, and group therapy for patients with diabetes for more than 30 years. She's also conducted workshops on adult play therapy and using humor to cope with chronic illness. She's an accomplished author and has written four books, including When Diabetes Hits Home, The Whole Family's Guide to Emotional Health. And she's co-written her most recent book with her best friend, Sandra, I'll tell you that in a minute, who is also a clinical psychologist, entitled Friendship Matters, Memoir, Life Lessons, and Laughter. Sandra is Dr. Sandra Neshin Bernstein. I don't think we're related, although you never know. PsyD, she's a licensed clinical psychologist who has worked both in school districts and universities. She's trained in psychotherapy, psychoanalysis, and as a school psychologist, she is in private practice on Long Island, where she treats both adolescents and adults, and she's co-written that book. So that should be a lot of fun and very interesting. But first, you know, there have been a lot of really fascinating movies on Netflix in the whole area of mental health. This is one of them, Eating Disorders at the Movies. I'm delighted to have as my guest Dr. Dina Cabrera, PsyD. She is a certified eating disorder specialist and executive clinical director at the Rosewood Center for Eating Disorders in California. She has extensive training in neuropsychological and psychological assessment, dialectical behavioral therapy, CBT treatment for patients with developmental disorders, behavioral problems, depression, and anxiety. She is co-author of the book, Mom in the Mirror, Body Image, Beauty, and Life After Pregnancy. It's a first-of-its-kind resource for mothers who are struggling with body images disturbances and eating disorders. She is here to talk with us about Netflix's newest original film, To the Bone, a fictional story starring Lily Collins, who struggled herself with an eating disorder. Dina, it's wonderful to have you on the show, and thank you for getting up so early.
Well, thank you.
I really appreciate it. having just been in Portland on last weekend, I get it. I mean, I think I'm still a little jet lagged. I was only there for 3 days. It's like, whoa. Okay. So first of all, we always like to find out a little bit about our guests. How did you get interested in psychology? And what about your story with eating disorders? How did you specifically decide to focus on that?
Well, sure. When I started college, I went to UCLA and I lived in the dorms. And my first roommate actually struggled with anorexia. And, you know, I'd known about eating disorders, but I had grown up in a small farming community. And, you know, being a young girl or a woman in this culture, you know, certainly knew about dieting, but
right.
didn't know to the extreme that eating disorders can be taken. And so she had struggled with compulsive over-exercising and anorexia. You know, our paths parted, and interestingly enough, a couple years later, had another roommate that struggled with bulimia. So long story short, you know, just really felt like, you know, as a friend, felt helpless, didn't know how to help, and was struck by, you know, the level of, you know, influences that not only was it about the eating disorder, it was about, in this roommate's case, a lot of the trauma that she was experiencing. So I just thought, you know, I thought, this is crazy. Why are women, and now, you know, I understand men too, obviously, but why are women doing this to their bodies? So it really led to a lifelong, you know, not only mission and passion, but trying to understand it from, you know, neurobiological, or at least from a psychological, biological perspective, because I knew there was more to it than just, you know, just food.
Yeah, no question. I mean, we've had a very dear friend struggling recently, and I want to say adolescent, you know, someone mm-hmm. who's in college. It's just, I mean, I've certainly seen patients, but, you know, this whole issue, and we'll talk about it as we talk about in the film, and I'm very interested in what, you know, your approach is at Rosewood, because I think mm-hmm. the other thing that happens is that there, you know, I've talked to, I don't know if you know Evelyn Atiyah, she runs sort of the whole eating disorder program at New York Presbyterian here in the mm-hmm. city, and, you know, there are a lot of hokey programs out there to treat people, so I worry about that too, you know.
Right, well, and that was what I was worried about a bit, you know, in watching the film. Because the film doesn't really show the treatment aspect of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, interesting.
So when you, yeah, so when families or someone sees that, and I can imagine, you know, them saying, what? Isn't anybody monitoring them? Is anybody watching them? So we can talk about that more, but that certainly is the case with treatment centers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I certainly do want to get to that. We'll keep you as long as we get. But first, for our listeners, could you just summarize a little bit about what the story is? We can also talk about my understanding. I don't know whether it was the writer and the producer also had an eating disorder, as well as Lily Collins, who's the actress who stars in it. But what is a little synopsis of the film? And I'm just fascinated that somebody who suffered would get thin to do the part. But that's another story.
Right, right. That's another interesting controversy. The movie is about, it's written and directed by Marty Noxon, and she herself did struggle with an eating disorder. And it is a bit of her story, even though she's just, you know, she does say it is a fiction story about a young girl, you know, battling with anorexia and really her family. And that was one thing I really respected about the film, is that they did bring in the family and showed the impact of this disorder on them. As, you know, we know, families are equally suffering alongside
right,
their loved
right.
one. And so I did appreciate that part. But it is a young girl and her journey of, you know, going into treatment and connecting with the other patients, perhaps even a little bit of a romance, and then, you know, really fighting and battling that internal battle of, you know, do I want to stay? Do I want to do this? What does staying in treatment mean for me? Which is really counterintuitive to the eating disorder, because it means, you know, obviously restoring weight, letting go of the eating disorder, and that's kind of her battle of, you know, what is her purpose? Why does she want to get better? And can she, you know, what is her past about that is, you know, really propelling her into this eating disorder in the first place?
And how, I'm sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead.
It covers a little bit of everything. It actually covers a lot of things. And that was maybe one of my criticisms. They tried to do too much.
Yeah.
And instead of, you know, telling a very simple kind of story, they really tried to throw too much. And a little bit thought, well, gosh, you know, did you get into Hollywood expectations? Is this about, you know, Hollywood demands of, you know, having, let's have a romance in the story. Let's have this whole scene with her biological mother. And that was a little very unconventional about trying to help her and feed her. So it was really, really kind of odd in certain places that doesn't at this point reflect what we would do in treatment today.
So you mentioned biological mother. The girl in the movie is adopted on top of everything. No, not adopted.
No, she's from a divorced family.
Oh, I see.
And
I see.
So the mother that you see in the family or in the scenes, especially in the beginning, like when she's, if you see in the trailer, she'll hand her a cake.
I see.
Yeah, that's actually her stepmother. So she comes from a divorced family, and it seems like, you know, the father's absent. And the other mother, her biological mother's in another same-sex relationship. So there's a lot of...
So they threw in too much. It reminds me of...
Yeah.
It reminds me that my daughter watches this is a little of a sidebar, a story called The Fosters, which is on ABC Family. And it's got everything under the sun, but it works. I mean, it's a series. It's not a movie, you know?
Right.
And if you're trying to do a movie about anorexia and you throw in all this other material, it does water down what the central premise is.
Right. And you don't get the theme of a story of somebody's journey when you're trying to, you know, oh, let's do this. And, oh, wait, let's just throw in this. And, you know,
I see. But I'm going to just do a little bit of a reintro for people who are just joining us, because regardless of the Netflix piece, which is a good kicking off point, I do want to talk about eating disorders. I'm Dr. Carol Bernstein here at NYU. I'm a psychiatrist. My guest is Dr. Dina Cabrera, PsyD. She is a certified eating disorder specialist and executive clinical director of the Rosewood Centers for Eating Disorders in California. She has extensive training in the treatment of eating disorders. So folks out there, if any of you have suffered from an eating disorder, does someone you love struggle with anorexia? Do you know someone who is purging, over-exercising, even if they're eating? This is an opportunity to talk with someone who has a tremendous amount of experience in the field. Our phone lines are open at 1-877-NYU-DOCS. That's 1-877-698-3627. You can also email us at docs@SiriusXM.com. So, Dina, could you talk a bit about because you said it's missing. I mean, we know what maybe we should first describe anorexia, bulimorexia, and bulimia so people understand the difference, and then talk a little bit about the impact on the families and the treatment approach at Rosewood.
Sure. Anorexia is a restriction of energy that is not enough, you know, to maintain a healthy weight. And there's different medical markers, such as for women, it would be maybe a loss of menstrual cycle.
Right.
you know, men, we might look at low testosterone, but definitely a significant restriction of energy. And a lot of that may be influenced by an overvaluation of shape and weight. So they're constantly focused on, you know, what size they are, weighing themselves. And then another part of that is it definitely interferes with their life. So it becomes all-consuming. It becomes, you know, they become hostage to their thoughts, their negative thoughts, and their obsession on food and weight. So basically, a lot of patients with anorexia will spend most of their day figuring out what not to eat. And so it becomes its own, you know, like I said, prison cell. And they'll exercise. There's different ways that they'll, some of them may, you know, purge, which means the self-induced vomiting, or they'll use laxatives, or perhaps they'll, you know, over-exercise. Now, bulimia is a little bit different. I mean, they can still do those compensatory behaviors, purging, laxative use, over-exercising, but it's also paired with binging. So taking in an enormous amount of food in a short amount of time, more than the average person, so to speak. It's not just overeating. It's really taking on a binge where they feel out of control, and they do it in secret because it's very shameful. And it usually is about 2 to 3 times a week, if not more. And it's coupled with the self-induced vomiting or other laxative use, diuretics, exercise. And then there's also binge eating disorder, which any of those compensatory behaviors like the purging or laxative use is used. It would be binging only. So it would be the taking in an enormous amount of food in a short amount of time, feeling out of control, feeling a lot of shame, and it's definitely causing dysfunction. Those are the three main disorders that are in the DSM-5. I think there's many people that have disordered eating.
Right.
that when you really talk to them and you see how much the self-loathing and the self-deprecation and the low self-esteem that comes along with it, I think, and the depression and the anxiety, I think oftentimes that is what is more devastating in terms of their health than, I mean, just as equally as binging and purging, no doubt, but somehow the way they feel about themselves is just as equally, you know, harming and unhealthy, because they're not living a life, you know, worth living to them. So I guess my point there is that we may not see it in the behaviors, but certainly maybe deep down inside or in their heads, they feel this way about themselves.
Right. I have a personal question, because I have actually thought this was different, but I may be wrong. The bulimorexia piece, the ones that binge and then do the laxative and purging and mm-hmm. over-exercising, who are painfully thin, is that group different in a treatment setting than people who just completely restrict? You know, because
a little bit, yes.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
terms of presentation, you mean in terms of personality presentation and behaviors? Definitely,
and also in terms of treatment receptivity.
Yes. There actually are, those patients are at most high risk for medical and nutritional complications. And they're the most, they tend to be more difficult to treat.
Which one? I'm sorry, which ones?
The ones who have anorexia with binge purge type.
Really?
With the purging, yes. They're the much more at medical risk because of the purging
right.
aspect and their
right.
low weight. So that compromises them
even more,
medically.
Doubly. Yeah.
Yes, and it puts them at risk for any kind of cardiac failure, seizures, because of the electrolyte imbalance. And they're so impulsive too. So there actually are patients that are also high risk for suicide. We have the highest mortality rate. Eating disorders have the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric illness, and much of that is not only due to the medical complications or the complications they can suffer because of the eating disorder. It's due to the significant high rate of depression. And so because it's very torturous to them, we have found that, you know, they do take their own lives because they just feel they can't get out of it. So it is very, very sad. But it is true that we do have a high rate of suicide as well.
What should parents do if they see that their child is losing weight like that? And I'm sure the parents see it. What should they do?
Definitely. I think one of the things that... they may see a weight loss and or weight gain, and they may see nothing. Sometimes those who are binging and purging aren't really having a fluctuation in their
right.
weight that parents can directly see. The first thing they may notice, though, is a mood change or an increase in anxiety. So depression, anxiety is definitely often present before an eating disorder will
right.
be noticed. We also see changes in maybe school, so their performance or their behavior in going to school, their grades, also maybe isolation, and then excuses. I see, you know, I hear a lot of families that just, I've already eaten. I don't feel like eating. Or food is missing, and where happened to the food, you know, so they'll eat in secret. So there's those mood issues that I probably would notice, or changes in friends. Why aren't you hanging out with so-and-so anymore? Loss of interest. So those things will definitely maybe be seen more. But what the families do is, I think, being very careful in how we, you know, present with our children, you know, listening more, but asking them, you know, are you struggling? I am, you know, learning. I know a lot about eating disorders. Or you could say I've Googled this. I feel like this might be happening with you. You know, can we talk about it? But being very careful not to blame them, or, you know, why are you doing this to yourself? Or why can't you just, you know, eat? Because we know that it's not about food, but it is about the food. And it's more about the emotional undercurrents that are fueling this behavior, that are making them want to control their food and or use food for comfort. So we see it both ways. I have a patient right now that, you know, comes from a really traumatic, you know, divorced family, and she used food as comfort. And not only did she use food, she used fast food. So she grew up divorced family, didn't have a whole lot of resources or money, and they ate fast food her whole life. So now we're trying to help her. She has binge eating disorder. We're trying to help her relearn how to eat. And she just doesn't know. She doesn't know how to make, you know, fresh, healthy meals. She doesn't know. And then not only that, they don't taste good because she's so used to eating a certain way. So it's really interesting. All that to say, I think, you know, having a compassion and empathy and really listening. You know, there's a lot going on. I think that's the message that I get from kids when I speak in schools. You know, what do you need? And, you know, they need someone to talk to and they need someone to listen. And so often another thing that I would say if, you know, I have a 16-year-old daughter is, you know, if you don't feel comfortable talking to me, you'll talk to someone. You know, talk to some. And fortunately, we have a lot of adults in our life that she could go to and feel comfortable. You know, I'll say, you know, talk to your vocal coach, or, you know, talk to your, you know, so-and-so that's, you know, that she knows through choir. So I think that is what I would encourage too. You know, at least have them talk to them and then talk to someone and or a therapist.
Yeah, so folks, if you're just tuning into us, we're talking about eating disorders. Our springboard here is a movie that just came out on Netflix called To the Bone. My guest is Dr. Dina Cabrera, who is a PsyD certified eating disorder specialist and executive clinical director of the Rosewood Centers for Eating Disorders in California. She has extensive training in neuropsychological and psychological assessment, dialectical behavior therapy, CBT, and CBT for patients with these disorders. If you know someone who is struggling with an eating disorder, either someone who's painfully thin or someone who's binging, or you're worried about that, or you see someone who's moving down that path, this is an opportunity to speak with an expert. Our phone lines are open at 1-877-NYU-DOCS. That's 1-877-698-3627. You can also email us at docs@SiriusXM.com. So, Dina, can you tell us a little bit about the treatment approach at Rosewood? We can talk about how families can get people into residential treatment. When is it needed? You know, you were talking about, you know, being empathetic with people who are struggling, but sometimes people reach a point where they're so thin they really need to get into residential treatment.
Right, and you start off that way, and then it gets to the point where you have to say, okay, it's time.
Gotta go.
Yes. Well, I really feel, you know, and this is what I tell parents, you know, sometimes we have to be that gauge or that, you know, so to speak, dashboard when we're the odometer and, you know, we're telling them, look, you know, we're reading this appropriately and you're not able to because you don't see it.
Right.
And that's a very important point. The eating disorder is a big fancy word we call egocentric, when everything is, it's wrong to everybody else, but it's not wrong to them. They don't feel that something's, you know, wrong. This is their way of controlling everything around them. And it's also, it's so complicated. It's also a biological, you know, mental health issue. So, well, what our approach is, the first thing that, you know, sometimes our intake coordinators, they spend anywhere from 2 weeks to a month to 6 months on the phone with someone.
Wow.
And trying, yeah, it's very true. You know, addiction is a little bit different, you know. I think there's a lot of, you know, obviously consequences there are with eating disorders too, but people might be losing their jobs or losing their license and they need to get into treatment for addictions. It seems to be a little bit easier for addictions, but for eating disorders, it's much more difficult. It's much more difficult to get insurance coverage as well. So my advice is, you know, sometimes there does need to be an intervention that needs to be done so that you can really fully, confront the patient and say, look, you're not seeing this. We're seeing this, you know, these obscene changes in behavior. You know, you barely, you know, able to function. You need to go inpatient. and this is, you know, holding you hostage. And so presenting them in that way and saying, you know, and having leverage, I'm not going to pay for college. Right. You're not going to be able to continue to stay here. I'm not going to continue to be able to support you. However, you know, whatever leverage you can use to get them into treatment to save their life, I think is imperative. And in doing so, and parents do have to get to that point where they have to say, I'm no longer paying for college. You've got to go to treatment. And sometimes that, you know, that does work. Most of the time it will at least get them in the door. So,
right. What, you know, I mean, I know of families where they keep trying to find a program that their daughter will accept, mm-hmm. but, you know, that yep. isn't necessarily the best program. So,
well, and there's no program that's going to be perfect and right. they're going to accept because they're not going to hear what they want to hear, which is, how can I still be in my eating disorder and get better?
Exactly. Right. How can I still stay skinny like this? And yeah, right.
It's like saying, you know, how can I, you know, continue, I don't know, smoking and, you know, get rid of this lung cancer. You know, you just can't. You just can't. You have to go through the steps, the process of treatment. And what treatment is about, we do have all different levels of care. So it can range from acute inpatient level of care where, you know, they are living there in a residential program, but it is in an intensive inpatient where, and in our facility, we're actually, our inpatient residential facility is in Arizona, and we are capable of treating the more medically ill patients that do need nasogastric tubes or they
right.
do need
wow.
IVs.
Right.
So it does sometimes get to that point. And then the recommendation is gradually stepping down into lower levels of care. So they start at inpatient. We also have a residential. And then we have a partial program. That's a day program. Sometimes patients start at the partial program, less autonomy, less structure, but they also get that support, learning how to cook their meals, being able to, learn their, we call them exchanges, but their balance, variety, moderation when it comes to food.
All right, I'm going to try to get to a couple of our callers.
Okay.
Maybe we got. I don't mean to cut off this important discussion about treatment, but we can sort of get into it. I'd like to welcome Kim from Maryland. You're on Dr. Radio here at Sirius XM 110.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have two 12-year-old girls or twins, and both of them seem to sneak candy and food into their room at times and eat it. They don't really ask to take it, or they just, you know, things are accessible in our house. And then I'll find all these wrappers, like they'll kind of eat a whole bag of candy. And I just wonder, is that an early sign of an eating disorder, or is that something to be concerned about?
Not necessarily. It might just be for fun. What is, you said those foods are easily accessible, that they're allowed to have candy and it's not a big deal?
Well, yeah, I do have a drawer with snacks in it, not necessarily candy, but, and sometimes they'll go out with their nanny or something and they'll buy some candy, a bag of it with their own money. And I just find a bunch of wrappers. Sometimes they kind of hide it in a little drawer or something, and I'm like, wow, why didn't you just throw these wrappers away? And I just didn't know if they were trying to hide the fact that they ate it, or, you know, I didn't really, I don't want to make a big deal about it, because on one hand, I don't want them to think that, you know, I'm watching over them in terms of everything they're eating. Like, it could go the other way, where they're going to start trying to be hiding things from me.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I would just encourage them. You know, I have a 13-year-old son. My son has done that. Well, he'll just take some wrappers, and which is just so interesting, because I'm not a big, I allow them to have candy. I just say, you know, please ask me, you know, because sometimes the answer is going to be yes, and sometimes it's going to be no, depending on the time of day and how much you had, or what we just had, or if it's right before dinner. So I try not to make too much power over food. I just simply say, you know, out of respect, you know, please, you know, one, throw away your wrappers, but two, ask me about when you're going to have candy, and we won't make it a big deal. Another thing for us, we say, you know, I always say, you know, just for, you know, bugs and, you know, roaches or whatever, you know, please don't take candy into your room. So I always, you know, I have a very you know, I just don't give food too much power. We try to live in, you know, balance, variety, moderation. There's no good food, there's no bad food, but there are healthier choices that, you know, might be better. And there's a place for candy, and there's a place for a Snickers bar and a cupcake. So I think that, you know, we just really have a very general attitude. I understand you not wanting to make a big deal out of it, because you're right. Some people can go to the extreme, and I typically hear those stories when candy is just forbidden. And I have a few friends, actually, whose their kids come over to my house, and the first thing they do is go for the candy jar. And my candy jar is left out, and the really doesn't even, like, you know, they'll take it or leave it. It just depends on the mood. But so I just really try to have that balance, variety, moderation attitude toward food.
Thank you very much, Kim. I think that's probably not an uncommon scenario. And I think that Dr. Cabrera has given you some really good suggestions. I think we have time quickly for one more call. I'd like to welcome Flora from Illinois. You're on Dr. Radio here at Sirius XM 110.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling. I have a 20-year-old son who has a binge eating disorder. I have him in therapy. I have him, he's on the spectrum with Asperger's.
Mm-hmm.
His father died from complications of addiction, and I also have a substance abuse disorder, which I'm treating with 12 steps. How beneficial do you find Overeaters Anonymous for young adults? And at some point, I'm looking for resources for kids who have some of those more cognitive-based challenges.
Adina, quickly, because we have about a minute left. Yeah.
Okay. Overeaters Anonymous has a different philosophy than we do as far as our food philosophy. They, from what I understand, is they believe in, you know, taking out certain processed foods or foods with sugar. I think no white flour, no white sugar. That actually is against really what our philosophy is. I kind of understand a little bit of the science behind that, but it doesn't seem to be helpful for those with binge eating disorder, because what it's doing is just causing them to binge more sometimes. If we have to take out those foods, imagine all the foods you have to take out, all white sugar, all, you know, white flour from their diet, and then what it does is often leads them to binging, because it's nearly impossible to take out sugar out of all our food. 70% of our food has sugar in it. So my point is I'm not sure how helpful that would be. I would definitely get him into an eating disorder specialist that can help with the developmental issues as well as, you know, the eating disorder. And there's some great resources in, you said you're in the Chicago area. There's some great resources in the Chicago area that could help him. But he definitely needs a balance of therapy and a dietitian to help him. This is a very difficult disorder, especially with Asperger population.
And I want to thank you, Flora. I'm so sorry. And I really want to thank my guest, Dr. Adina Cabrera, certified eating disorder specialist and executive clinical director of the Rosewood Center for Eating Disorders in California. I really want to thank you a lot. We're going to have to go to break. And after that, we're going to have open phones, which means we can continue the conversation about other issues in mental health, eating disorders, anxiety, Asperger's, any of those issues. I'm Dr. Carol Bernstein. We'll see you in a few minutes.